Hi everybody, and welcome to the first in our epic Twin Peaks rewatch, which was prompted by David Lynch announcing that the seminal TV show that aired 24 years ago will be coming back to our TV screens next year. So what we're going to do is watch the episodes in small groups in turn and try not to spoil it, so if you've never watched it before you can follow along at home. My name is Bina007 and I have watched it all before many times, including when it originally aired, which makes me very old. And I am joined today by three Twin Peaks virgins, including, first of all, the man too sexy to button his shirt, East Texas Direwolf.
Hello, this is Shane, East Texas Direwolf from the forum.
I will append the photograph so listeners can see what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
Seeing as you appear to be incredibly proud of them, so that would only be fitting. I'm also joined by Claudius the Fool.
Hello, this is Greg.
And I think the first time we're podcasting together, SJ Lee.
Hi, I'm SJ Lee on the forum, or Stephen.
Excellent, so thank you all for waking up so very early. So it might be useful just to go around the group and just say, like, obviously you haven't watched Twin Peaks before, but, you know, what were you expecting? And having watched the pilots and episodes 1 and 2, is it what you're expecting, and are you excited to continue, or are you just utterly confused? So maybe if we go with Stephen first.
So obviously the show is a huge pop culture icon, right? So there's a ton of people who watch it and loved it. So for the last few years, I've heard people talking about it, especially as Netflix has become more popular and the show has become more accessible for people.
Okay, so is it on Netflix in the US and Canada then?
Yeah, so okay. I recently got Netflix, as in last weekend. So one of the first things I did is finally check out Twin Peaks and see what it's all about. I've heard a great deal about it, mostly that it's amazing and incredibly weird. So I've just been kind of waiting for those two things to present themselves to me as I watch the show.
And not quite yet? You're not feeling the amazingness?
I think the problem is that I've heard so much about it that I'm just waiting for it to... All right, let me put it this way. When you watch the show, at least in my opinion, it starts off as a very normal mystery, and it's getting progressively weirder. And I could see where if I was watching it and had no idea how strange it was going to get, it would have turned me off by now. But by fact that I've been told how good it is, I'm just waiting and going to keep on going with it regardless.
Well, in that, I think it's probably one of the few shows that was probably as hyped before it came out as for you guys watching it later, because at the time there was a huge advertising campaign and it was this huge event TV, like David Lynch is coming to the small screen and it's going to be insane. So I think in a way, even as first viewers, we were pretty hyped about it. How about you, Shane? Is it what you were expecting?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, like Steven said, it's big in pop culture. I've heard a lot about it, knew it was weird. But I like weird stuff. I like things, you know, that are just interesting and things you can chew on and wrap your head around. So it's pretty much what I expected so far, and I'm liking it.
Cool. And Greg?
Yeah, kind of like Steven, I've had it in my Netflix queue for a while, and this kind of prompted me to actually commit to it and watch it. But it's like you said, it's been in the culture. I'm used to people saying like, "Oh, that's some Twin Peaks shit right there," and at least now I understand what that's in reference to. It took me a little just while to get it into the vibe of the show. Like, okay, I get what's happening here. But like Steven said, it started off as a pretty straightforward mystery, and then it's like, "Oh, that's kind of odd. Okay." So I'm at the point where I'm just trying to keep track of who's sleeping with who and what's going on.
Everybody's sleeping with everyone, right?
Right. It's, I was talking to my friend at work about it. It's weird. Like, there's 50,000 people in this town, but we are shown the same, like, 8 people and who they're sleeping with over and over again. But it just seems super, super small. But I know it's there's a lot more going on there. But it's I'm told it's like a precursor to the X-Files in vibe a little bit. And I love the X-Files. And I'm definitely on board with it now. And I like The Elephant Man. It's one of my favorite movies. That's really my only other David Lynch stuff that I've gotten into.
Has anybody else seen The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas musical?
No.
No.
Well,
it's a Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton musical from the early 80s. But there's a song in it called Sneaking Around With You, and that's what the pilot made me think of.
Is it a film we should check out? Is it worth watching?
I like it. It's funny, but it's kind of a nostalgia thing. I saw it when I was, I'm sure, way too young to see it, because it's about a whorehouse. But, but so that song, I Will Always Love You, from The Bodyguard, it's from Dolly Parton, wrote it for The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. It's in that movie. That's where it came from.
Oh, okay. So did it feel dated to you guys?
Not at all.
But in a weird way, right? Because it's kind of half 50s, half 80s. So the 80s stuff, all the perms, looks very dated. But to me, it actually seemed like it was in its own little world then. It felt dated at the time. And it kind of feels dated in its own weird way. I don't know.
It seems like it's in a... It says the population's 50,000, but it seems like a much smaller town. And it seems like it's sort of up in the backwoods. So I could kind of go with it being, you know, not quite high fashion and up to date at times.
And I guess before we plunge into the episodes, at this stage, who do you think killed Laura Palmer? Just so I can inwardly laugh.
Well, I think I've been spoiled for it, so I'm not going to say.
Oh, okay, so you know. That's a shame. That's a shame if you know. Anyone else who doesn't know genuinely?
Well, actually, I thought that the whole thing about the show is that we still don't know who killed her, so I don't know who actually killed her. But I get a weird, I mean, I get a creepy vibe from everybody, but that doctor with the earplugs, he's probably my number one suspect.
Dr. Jacoby. At my stage of watching it, like where you are now, I thought it was Dr. Jacoby, I have to admit.
Well, it's like they're throwing him at you as the weird, crazy guy, but he like came right up to them and was like, hey, I've been with Laura, so I don't think he would have killed her.
The bit where he's like, just... ooh, can I see the dead body? And they're like, no, that's not actually strictly protocol.
Yeah, but I thought he was like her, he told them that, oh, I didn't know, no one knew Laura was seeing me. Like, I thought they meant that he was like her gynecologist or something, like or he was taking, like giving her the pill. And I didn't know that he was like her psychologist. It was weird, but yeah, it was just odd. Yeah, but I'll go with Dr. Jacoby.
How about you, Steven? Do you know, or are you guessing?
The show is so difficult to piece together. Like I said earlier, you're just trying to figure out who's sleeping with who and who all these characters are and how they relate to one another. In my gut, I don't know if we've met the killer yet. I feel like they've set up a lot of potential killers. And no, I don't think we've met the true killer yet. If we do meet them, like Greg said, I know the ending is strange, if there is an ending. So I don't know what to expect.
I mean, I think there's definitely an issue whereby the network was probably very interested in finding the killer, and David Lynch probably didn't give a shit at all, just wanted to keep the sort of the weird vibe going. So there is a bit of a tension that will become apparent, I think, as you move through more and more. But yeah, we will find out. So I guess we can go through the pilot and the first two episodes. So from the concept of the show is that each day basically corresponds to an episode. So the pilot is effectively the first day when Laura is discovered. And I kind of think it splits into three parts. So you have the first part, which is sort of the death is discovered and everyone in the town is mourning her. The second part is when Dale Cooper arrives and the investigation begins, which is sort of the afternoon, I guess. And then you have in the evening, kind of seeing all the lovers sneaking around and trying to digest the information. So I thought maybe I'd just do it.
And nobody's too discreet about sneaking around either.
Yeah, everybody knows. Everybody knows. Even the guy who's like, ooh, your husband who's like in jail for manslaughter, who I'm evidently scared about, like, even they're not discreet.
They're having a nice romantic dinner at a biker bar. I don't know what's not discreet about that.
Exactly. I had forgotten just how crazy Nadine was. sorry. So I'm just going to summarize like the morning bit, and then I guess we can discuss that. So the town learns of Laura's murder. So the pilot opens with this like hugely bizarre piece of objectification, which is the face of Josie Packard. And you see Pete Martell go down fishing, and he discovers this dead body wrapped in plastic, which I guess is one of the most iconic images from Twin Peaks. And he calls the sheriff Harry S. Truman, which is hilarious. You get in the midst of all this, like this awful thing of discovering this body, this really hilarious conversation where the PA Lucy is like trying to explain to the sheriff which phone exactly she's put the call through to. And then
that was amazing.
Lucy's one of my favourite characters. Lucy and Deputy Andy, who looks a bit like, is it Stan Laurel or Olive Ardy? He looks one of the two of them.
Laurel, he definitely looks like Laurel.
Yeah, exactly. It's just so funny to me.
I'm sorry, Harry, I can't stop crying.
Yeah, he's so sweet. And actually, one of the themes of this early section is everybody crying uncontrollably, right? I mean, it's amazing. And then you have, you switch to, after Andy starts crying uncontrollably, to the school. And, you know, the mum ringing around trying to find out where her daughter is, including the parents of Laura's boyfriend, Bobby, who turns out to be like a high-ranking major who we never really figure out why Twin Peaks has this like highly decorated
He's that guy that played that military guy in every movie in the 80s, who I still don't know his name, but it's that guy.
It's true, isn't it? He is in like everything. I don't know what his name is. He looks so credible, though. I basically imagine that he runs the US Army today. And then you have, like, I think one of the most amazingly shot scenes is where Laura's best friend, Donna, in school, sees a girl screaming, running outside the classroom, and realizes as the police come to her homeroom that something's happened to her when she sees the empty seat.
Yep, this school scene, I knew it was going to be weird, but the scene that really clinched it for me is when it showed, the bell rang and it shows all the kids going back to their room, and that one kid does, like, the backwards moonwalk off the screen. It's like, ooh, that was just weird, and I knew that was sort of setting the tone, and I haven't seen that guy again, but he just, like, danced off the screen, and I knew something was up.
There's a lot of random dancing, actually. I wonder if David Lynch is, like, if that's a thing for him. But it is fantastic. And even like Audrey Horne, who's just so cool, you know, just lighting a cigarette, leaving it in her locker. I love Audrey Horne.
I don't understand her. That whole family, like, I just want more information. But that's part of the beauty of it, is that you don't get it, I guess.
Yeah, she's certainly a character. And actually, I think she never looks as pretty as in the pilot, because she has that really lovely like crop haircut that she then grows out. So she looks really 1950s in the pilot.
I thought Donna looked a lot better in the pilot than she did in the rest. It looks like she just came out of a salon, and then in the rest of the next two episodes, it kind of looked like she had just done her own hair.
Yeah. Like, I wonder if there was just more money for the pilot.
Could be.
Sorry. And how did you guys feel about the whole Packard sawmill deal and Ben Horn and his attorney, Leland Palmer? Like, do you find Ben Horn to be a convincing anti-hero, or I don't know?
At this point,
I
was still
a bad guy.
At this point, I was still just trying to. I wasn't sure if he was going to be, you know, who was the main players and who were, you know, just sort of ancillary characters. So I was still kind of just trying to figure everybody out.
It's true, actually. There's a lot of main characters in this. It's a big cast to wrap your head around. I was kind of admiring when I was writing notes on it, like just how quickly they introduce everybody. And then we have what I call the discovering who's like sleeping around with everyone else section. So you cut to the diner where the high school quarterback, Bobby Briggs, is giving his lover Shelley a ride home, only to discover that her old man Leo is already there. Which I used to find Leo when I was a kid really scary, but looking at it now with that greasy ponytail, I was like, why did I ever find this guy threatening?
He's the guy that seemed to me like the most obvious suspect. So I thought, okay, he's probably not the one that did it, but he seemed like the most obvious.
Yeah, like Leo and Horn seem like the most obvious villains of the piece. Therefore, I'm immediately discounting them as the actual killer.
Yeah, but not nice people regardless, I guess.
Oh no, they both seem like terrible monsters, but not killers.
And then we have the other terrible monster of the piece. You go to the Packard sawmill, and we discover that the other girl is missing, Janet Pulaski, and Josie shuts down the mill because her father works at the mill, and Catherine's obviously really horrible, and she just like summarily sacks someone. And I was thinking at the time that maybe like this, like the Catherine and Ben Horn characters in particular, this is right at the tail end of Dallas and Dynasty, and maybe they're spoofing that kind of soap opera capitalist bitch sort of trope that we had in the 80s on TV.
Yeah, I thought, I was like, oh, what a bitch. Let's just sack that guy. That was messed up.
Yeah, she's awesome, right?
Yeah, Piper Laurie, I mean, she always plays like the memorable, awful person from like Carrie's mother, even through a lot of the TV stuff that she's done. So I knew she was going to not be one of the good guys in this show.
Yeah, and so at this stage, because you don't really know much about Josie Packett, like, are you surprised to just see her like in this tiny bumblefuck town that they have this stunning Asian woman just running the mill? It always struck me as like really bizarre as a character.
Until they justified it at the town meeting, I was very, very confused. But I just keep an open mind and let this whole show wash over me and try not to challenge too much of what's being put directly in front of my face.
Indeedy. And then I guess the final bit of this kind of opening is James Hurley riding up to Big Ed's gas farm, which I'm assuming that even in 1990s America was very unusual to have this really old-fashioned petrol station.
Well, I don't know. That's like, I mean, I still... when I go upstate New York, like, there's little towns that look like it's right out of the 50s, and, like, there are stations like that, but it's that whole, like, mashup of 50s to 1990s culture, like, you don't know when, you know it's the 90s, but it does feel like the 50s, but it was a little odd, you know, with the the hand pumps and just the old-fashioned aspects of everything.
And even the bike he's riding, and I was thinking even Bobby with his sort of T-Bird leather jacket, it's, yeah...
Well, yeah, you've got like the football players with the Letterman jackets, and then you got like the greasers, and it's just an odd mashup.
But Bobby had his letter set into the back of a leather jacket. I've never seen that, and I thought that was so funny.
What?
Bobby, on the back of his leather jacket, he's got the letter like from school, like you would see on a Letterman jacket. And I've never seen it on because it's kind of like a. The letters, you know, like, it's always kind of represent the cool or the quote-unquote popular kids. And then the leather jackets always represent the sort of bad boys or, you know, other side of the track kids. And it's kind of a mishmash of both of that.
Oh, okay. So I totally didn't get that, I guess. I didn't realize the whole... We don't have that in England, so that didn't strike me as odd at all. So what's the deal? So if you play for a team, if you play for a sports team in school, you get one of those jackets. Is that how it works? Or
you get the letter, and then they have a certain style of jacket that you have to buy, and you can put it on there, like the jackets with the colored sleeves. I think what's Bobby's friend?
Mike.
Yeah, does he wear one?
Yeah.
A regular leather Letterman jacket? Golly, I can't talk.
It's early.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what was your kind of like reactions to the way in which the body is discovered and the town's reaction? And I mean, it's pretty OTT, or were you kind of just sliding with it at this point?
When we were talking about how the show feels dated, the reaction of the characters in the show kind of triggered that response for me, that the show is just from a very different time period. But I wasn't sure if that was just, you know, Lynch's choice of how the show should feel. It felt very soap, like a soap opera, very cheesy, very melodramatic. You know, we don't see people like rending their clothing and screaming in agony anymore in a show like this. So it was very strange and jarring. You know,
I think it was
like
meant
watching...
to be deliberate, though. I think he always modeled it on Peyton Place, so there's really like Serkian melodramas. You know, Dallas and Dynasty, which I did also watch, were ridiculous, but I think not as deliberately so as this. I hope.
I thought the high school principal starting crying when he was trying to do the announcement. I thought that was hilarious. I mean, up until this point, I thought it was kind of played straight and I was kind of going with it, but then he was just totally ridiculous. I thought it was funny.
True. Anything else on this section of the pilot? I mean, the look of it, I think that's the other thing that got me. It just looked so beautiful. Like, all the girls are just stunning, and like the waitresses at the diner, it's all shot in this way that's just so dreamy and lovely. But even the Great Northern, So on to the middle section, which is basically, so the mechanics of the show is that because Janet Pulaski has stumbled through that railway bridge and over state lines, the FBI are called in. So you get Agent Dale Cooper showing up. So did you guys, were you familiar with the Coop character? Because I mean, that's like the most iconic of Twin Peaks, like the whole kind of obsession with cups of coffee and cherry pie and what are these pine trees? Nope, Karen.
No, I knew nothing. I always knew that he was the main guy in it, and I always thought he was like the straight guy to all the quirkiness that went on. But then when he started all his little like stuff, I was like, oh, he's the oddball in this. And it definitely, I knew nothing going in, and I found it thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah, he's definitely one of the most quirky people, especially when we get to the Tibetan deduction scene, I guess. he looks so young.
I use that all the time. What are you talking about?
Really, has that yielded good results for you, Shane?
Oh, of course. That's how I pick where I'm going to go eat dinner.
And it's like, you know, after they've done that scene in the woods, and then you cut to another scene in the sheriff's station, and Lucy's just sitting there with, like, a copy of this massive book with Tibet on the front of it, and no one comment. And it's just like, yeah, Lynch has great, you know, feeling for the plight of Tibet, so he's just going to throw that into a network show.
I thought Cooper was a straight man too coming into this. So yeah, I was like, holy cow, this dude is crazy.
Well, he looks like the straight man. He looks like the caricature of the straight man, I guess. You know, the ridiculously slick back hair and the mac. And, everybody was in love with him at the time. He's aged really badly, hasn't he? Like when you see the aged Cooper in the Red Room at the end of the second episode, he does not look as bad as the real aged Cooper in real life.
Oh, I think he's nice as the mayor of Portland on Portlandia. It's quite endearing. He's different.
Yeah.
He just showed up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He looks alright.
Did he? Really? Which episode are you guys on? We just had the first episode of season 2 last night.
We're on the third or fourth, I think. Oh. I think fourth.
Broadcasting from the future. I have to say, I was not feeling Ward's beard. And also, the suicide attempts? Really? But anyway, that's a side note.
I can't handle any more geeky comic book talk after last night.
Oh, you guys had your comic book podcast, didn't you?
I think I was quiet for 45 minutes.
Did you do Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. last night?
Yeah, we talked about it.
Okay, cool. I look forward to listening to that, man. But anyway, so as far as it goes, like this whole kind of the pace at which the investigation begins, like, it kind of starts off looking fairly sensible, like he's looking for stuff under the nails, and he finds the letter R, you know. And what I find kind of really weird is, like, Sheriff Truman just stands there looking, like, really, you know, like, naive the whole time. So I guess basically what happens is they examine the bodies, they pull out the letter R from under one of Laura's nails, they find the deposit box key in her diary, and a bag with cocaine residue, which Truman seems really shocked about. And when they unlock the deposit box, they discover $10,000 and a copy of Flesh World, which is a porn magazine featuring a picture of Ronette Pulaski and Leo Johnson's truck. So all very grim. Although when they go into the room with the safety deposit box and there's a random head of like a dead, I don't know, moose or something. Like, what is that? I have no idea.
That's a deer, I think.
Is that a deer? I always wondered if it was just there or if that was just Lynch doing it deliberately.
Living in a northern town, I would totally not be surprised to walk into a bank and see something like that. Really? I honestly did not notice or bat an eye. It's like a gas station for me. It's like, I've seen gas pumps probably from the 40s up here. So I am no way baffled by things like that.
Okay, so you just think that's just straight observational. That's interesting because, growing up in sort of fairly urbanized England, I was just like, this is all very weird indeed.
Oh, I grew up in a major metropolitan area of this country. I just live in the backwoods now.
Ah, okay.
So it's all weird, but it's normal weird now.
Okay. And then basically we end this sort of section with a town meeting where Truman gives Cooper a bit of a backstory on Josie and that her husband apparently died in a boating accident a year ago. And we meet the log lady. Yes. So had you heard of her before? Because she's pretty iconic. And
I didn't. I purposely didn't like look, I didn't Google anything Twin Peaks because I really just want to experience it fresh, and I didn't see that coming, but she's an oddball, and I hope we get some answers, but I wouldn't be surprised if we get no answers from her.
She is awesome. Oh, I forgot in this whole section we have Audrey Horne. First of all, sabotaging the concierge's papers by putting the pencil in the coffee. And then the Norwegians, who now I can't watch without thinking of Patrick the Tall and Shellfish.
Does he call you a pretty little girl?
Oh, so hilarious. Yeah, she's just brilliant.
Yeah, I didn't know if she's meant to be, like, actually crazy, because later when you find out that she has an something's up with her brother, we don't know if he's autistic or if he was, you know, in an accident or something, but you know something's up with that family, and she might not physically be exuding craziness, but something's up with her, and just from her actions that we see, and it's just weird, and she's one that's straight out of the 50s, and half the time I don't know if that's like her theme song playing or if there's actually music playing wherever she is. That like steamy 1950s, it's just odd, and it's always like off, something's off about her.
So you think she could actually be mentally unwell at this point?
Well, I got that, but I don't know if that's her just like rebelling against her rich dad who doesn't care about her. But then when like the brother shows up later, it's like, oh yeah, there's something just weird going on with this family. But I think she's definitely off balance.
This is true.
I just took her to be, you know, sort of the spoiled little rich girl that does things just because she can.
Yeah, the spoiled little rich girl who wants attention and knows she can get away with it, maybe.
Yeah, that's how I read her, too.
But yeah. I thought that scene was funny with the cup. I was like, is there anything in that cup? It's like, she's not just going to pull it out, is she? And then, you'd think her mom, if she knows her, would know that she would. But I guess not.
Indeed. But the best one is when she just sort of wanders into the room and the guys just carry on translating, and it's just so brilliant.
Yeah. Head snap in unison.
Yeah. But it does, like, they do portray the Nordic people to be naive and fond of cheese and fresh air. Don't they?
So it's a totally accurate, culturally sensitive depiction.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. Just, I mean, like, we can talk about this maybe as we get further on, but, like, the treatment of Deputy Hawk as well is very much of its time, I suspect.
Yeah. Go find the trail.
Yeah, exactly.
Tonto.
Yeah. Okay, then we get to, like, the final bit of the pilot, which is at night time. Like, the days seem to go on forever, like, so much. You could not say that this TV show lacks for plot, so
I didn't catch up on the each episode is a day thing until the third episode, when we'll get there, but Donna and her boyfriend pick up from the last episode at the house on their little quote-unquote date. I was like, is this the same night? They're just rolling right into it, huh?
Yeah, it was weird, like, you know, you got to the end of the two series and you realized that in Twin Peaks time you'd covered about a month. It's pretty intense because so much happens. So, yeah, that night, Donna overhears her father tell her mother about the locket, and she sneaks out to meet James with the help of her sister, who's really, I love her sister, writing poetry, and, like, when Donna gets busted and she says, Dad, I'm going to tell it to you. I kind of think that maybe I was probably like her sister at that age, just, like, slightly weird and odd. And
she seems like an old soul.
Yeah, exactly. Just a child out of time. And then, basically, her dad calls up Coop and Truman, who are staking out the roadhouse, and they know that Donna's going to go out and try and meet James, or a rider who they think's going to, you know, be involved in the killing. And then Ed meets Norma at the roadhouse, and they agree to leave their spouses for each other, which is just, yeah. You know, having an affair 101, this is not the way to do it without getting discovered. Not that I should be encouraging people to have affairs, but I would suggest.
Well, can we talk about the actual roadhouse itself and that weird, like, is that the kind of music that is normally played in roadhouses? Because that did not seem accurate.
No way. That can't
okay,
be right.
I don't have
can't
much roadhouse experience.
But do roadhouses actually exist? I mean,
there's biker bars. It was like a biker bar. And then there's this like 1980s, like new wave, I don't know, just ethereal Enya type singing.
Yeah. And what's even more funny is that that music just keeps on going without interruption when there's a massive bunch up. Like, the band doesn't stop. No one looks up. It's, yeah.
At this point, I'm kind of loving the Cooper Truman buddy cop movie that's going on.
Yeah, they are a bromance, aren't they? They're so sweet. But it's very much a sort of It's an unquestioned hierarchy that Coop knows everything and Truman's just like the bumbling happy idiot. It's a little bit Sam and Frodo, actually.
I was happy to see Truman sort of stand up for himself a little bit in the third episode when the forensic guys get there.
Oh, Albert Rosenfield. He's my hero. He's awesome.
Yeah, I'm not really enjoying the partnership too much because Truman does seem like he's just following around Cooper, who's making these great leaps of logic, and somehow he's always right. I want Truman to be a little more assertive and, you know, hit him to point to something and be right to kind of balance out the partnership.
I mean, I have to say that Truman at this point is just a sort of donut munching idiot. And
well, we haven't mentioned the donuts yet, and that lovely spread that they have every morning.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I could totally eat a donut right now. Oh, yeah, and just the sheer volume of coffee they all drink. Although from a European's perspective, the fact that like Cooper's idolizing this coffee and it's just like cheap American filter coffee from a jug, that from a European perspective, like, all American coffee sucks because it's just so weak and watery. He's like, what is this? Like, I remember when I was a kid, like, and I hadn't been to the US, thinking, how does everyone on TV just drink so much coffee? And then you go to America and you realize, it's so weak. That's why. So, I had an issue. Sorry, I've insulted your national...
Defend your honor, Americans.
I don't drink coffee, so.
You guys
don't even like Starbucks. I'm a Dunkin' Donuts man, but I'm not like a coffee snob by any means, so I'll take it. It's probably true.
I'm assuming Canada has better coffee just because of the French influence.
I can't speak to it. I don't drink coffee.
People.
But you'd have to try our national obsession, Tim Hortons, which some people say is absolute dumpster coffee, and other people treat like it's heroin, so I have no idea.
Tim Hortons, okay, we'll bear that in mind.
Tim Hortons, yes. If there's one brand you should affiliate with this country, it's that.
I've never heard of these Tim Hortons, but I don't think we have them in the U.S.
There's a few, not many.
Aren't they like combo like coffee and burger joints? Or
no,
didn't they try to do burgers?
God,
at
no.
One...
No, no,
no, didn't
no.
They try? I thought there was a burger connection. I don't know. It all comes from stories I hear on podcasts about Canadians.
No, it's just it's a straight up chain donut coffee shop.
Okay.
Dale Cooper.
I think they tried to do burgers at one point, and it was like a complete failure. They're like, Tim Hortons doing burgers, and the country was like, no, thank you.
Yeah, there would be riots in the streets. I'm not joking.
So the coffee's
Steven,
good.
I just realized you're Canadian.
Absolutely, yes, I am Canadian.
That's. I got a question for you later. We'll save it.
Okay.
Oh no, you should do it now. Now that we're on this like little Canadian sidetrack.
Are all the whorehouses that awesome up there?
Yes.
I work in education, so I can't personally answer that question.
I forgot One Eye Jax is in Canada, so.
Yeah, the elusive and exotic Canada.
Where all the whores wear sort of elaborate playing card lingerie outfits.
Oh, everything needs a theme. I mean, how are you going to differentiate yourself from the other border town whorehouses?
It did seem like ludicrously high-end, given that most of the clientele must be basically truckers. But yeah.
I've never experienced it myself, but I've been told or have heard it's kind of a meme that like Montreal whorehouses or strip joints or what have you are like legendary and mainly from American tourists. So... Leave that as you will.
Okay. Well, if one of the two listeners to this podcast happens to be from Montreal, then they should definitely write in and let us know whether the whorehouses are indeed spectacular, because I kind of want to know now. So yeah, anyone from Montreal, let us know. Right. Where were we?
A tangent was roughly as weird as this show.
Yeah. But it was, like, the first time I saw those hookers with, the playing card stuff on, I was just like, what is this? And I was quite young at the time, so I was kind of like, well, you know, maybe this is what whorehouses look like. Of course, I know better now with my great life experience.
I was surprised to see how revealing the costumes were at that time on regular TV.
Because I thought they actually weren't, and I thought it was a way of making them not be revealing. Like, by the standards
compared to like Littlefinger's brothel, there's nothing.
Yeah, or the Sopranos, you know, there's very little on show, I thought.
Yeah, but this is on like broadcast network TV. It was probably on at 9 o'clock or whatever, though. So
true. Yeah, it's one of the points which really does date it, because all the whores have these like really massive, what we'd call fringes, but bangs, you know, like really with a lot of hairspray. It's very 80s. Anywho, so we're at the Roadhouse. And basically everyone turns up. So you've got Big Ed with Norma. You've got Coop and Truman staking it out. You've got Donna going in to meet James and getting snuck out the back where she does meet him. And effectively you have Bobby and Mike. Oh no, they're not there yet. That's a different episode. So basically, as the episode winds down, you basically have Donna and James, who I think are the two most boring characters in the pilot, riding off and declaring their undying love for each other.
Bobby and Mike got there already.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because they
yeah,
do.
I don't
they
know
have
if
the
there was a different
in.
Way that they showed it, because there's the 90-minute pilot. I don't know if it was broken up differently on the DVDs or anything, but yeah, that's all. I think
because
that's all
the way Donna gets out of there is they're distracted by the fight that Bobby
of course, there. Yes. So there's a huge punch-up, but the singing goes on regardless. And then you have the kind of, like, the really syrupy, gloopy love scene. And they bury the locket together and agree they're going to find Laura's killer because only they loved her, even though they're now making out. and a mysterious glove hand digs up the locket and takes it, which at the time completely freaked me out and I had total nightmares.
It freaked me out the other night.
Really? I feel less bad now.
I was watching it late and by myself and the lights were out and Mom starts screaming. It's like, oh, kind of jumped.
That's that took me out of it. I couldn't take it seriously. It's like, yeah, I get it that the mom's feeling this, but it was she had screamed so much in that episode, and she did an amazing job. Like you could definitely feel her pain, but that scene just didn't work for me. When like the hand touches it and she freaks out, it just completely took me out of it. It was one of the few times I was like, oh, give me a break. But
oh, what you thought it was too coincidental and too
yeah, it was just too like yes, I know she's feeling her daughter. There's a connection there, and something bad just happened, but. You know, if it was like something happening to her, her daughter, and she was as a mother feeling it, but it's like her daughter's locket. It was just too much for me. But
the locket took me out of it, but for very different reasons. I just wondered how the hell did this person find this locket in the middle of the dark woods at night?
Because he'd been following Donna and James to where they buried it, I think.
That makes sense.
Yeah, rather than being psychic or using Tibetan deduction.
That would not be unrealistic in this show.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there is meant to be a sense that Sarah Palmer's reaction is somehow psychically linked to the locket. But I love, actually, it's pretty worth pointing out, or like, how did you like, given this is David Lynch and he loves the kind of the sinister nature of suburbia, like the way in which they film the Palmer house and her mom and this very kind of claustrophobic interior and that ceiling fan, like the sinister sound of it. Did you guys pick up on that, or were you just like, oh, this is ridiculous and over the top?
Oh no, over my head. So.
Okay.
Well, I just thought the house looked kind of small and modest. That seemed like her dad was a big shot, so I was expecting something a little more grandiose. Seemed like just kind of a regular old little house.
True, actually. I never really thought about that. I guess Lehman's... Yeah, because Doc Hayward's house seems a bit bigger and flasher, doesn't it? I always used to find it really weird of the pilot that Doc Hayward, who I presume is just like a family doctor, was doing autopsies. But
well, see, that kind of went to the... Is it a small town or a big town thing? Because it kind of feels like a small town, so I figured he was like the town doctor. But then a town of 50,000, surely there's going to be quite a few.
So yeah, I thought he was like the county coroner or something, and then only later we found out he was just like a regular doctor. Because the first time you see him, he's at the crime scene, so I thought he was the coroner they brought in.
So what would you count as a big town then? Because I grew up in a town of 100,000, and that felt very much like a small town. But so I
don't know. My town's got 2,000.
That ain't a town, mate. That's a village.
Hamlet.
Yeah, I agree with Shane. I find that the number of people in Twin Peaks and the way Lynch makes the town feel are discordant. Like, the town feels like 10,000 or 5,000 people, not 50,000 people. And like Shane, I live in a town of 2,400 people right now.
Yeah, village. My village has 6,000 people and it's a village.
Yeah, I had 50,000 people in my town, city growing up, and it's definitely... If it's the same amount of people living in Twin Peaks, then Twin Peaks must be just spread out over half the state because there's a lot of space. But it's the Pacific Northwest. I have no, I've never been up there, so maybe it's different.
And then what was weird to me is when you find out that Janet Pulaski worked at Horn's department store, and because it felt so small, it just felt to me like it would have like a town store on Main Street, but it wouldn't have a big department store with a perfume counter. So mm-hmm. That it kind of feels like they'd have to go to the big town, 30 miles away to do that. So yeah, that always struck me as a bit weird as well.
What is one of those shows that they keep going out of the way of never setting it in a specific, I mean, we pretty much know it's got to be Washington, right? But they don't never say exactly where it is. It's always Twin Peaks, not even when he's recording into his thing, they never specifically say where it is.
Right. Yeah. Any other comments on the pilot, or should we move on to the next episode?
I've been joined by my son, so I'm going to be muted quite a bit.
Well, he's welcome to chime in. Okay, so episode one, which is called Traces to Nowhere, but actually at the time they didn't have titles. I think it was just something they did for the DVD release, maybe. So what happens in this episode? This is like day two, so it's the first full day of the investigation. Coop wakes up in the Great Northern dictating his notes to Diane.
I'm very curious about Diane.
I have a theory.
What's your theory?
Well, until the other FBI guy showed up later, I thought he was actually just some crazy guy pretending to be an FBI agent. But I don't understand who Diane could be, like his secretary, but he's never sending stuff off to her, and how is she getting him? But I actually thought that he was just made up, and like there is no Diane. It's just like him talking to himself.
That would be fantastic.
That would be awesome if the whole thing's a hoax.
That's kind of what I was thinking, is just some figment of his imagination that he just talks to in his notes.
I think it's probably something of its time. I remember my dad at the time like dictating notes to his PA, then every day he should get the microcassette and type it all up. So maybe it's just a sort of a weird thing from back in the day.
Well, that's like another thing I think I see from like John Cheever stories in 1950, like Mad Men, where you record into the dictaphone and then you give it to your girl. Like that's another, it seems like that's a 50s thing, not an 80s, 90s thing. But it just goes with the whole weird mashup of timelines that he has going on.
Yeah. Oh, so you think it's like it's recording to be transcribed? I just assumed he would just record it to make a record of it.
Well, it's like very specific about stuff that's going on at the moment. So I don't know, but I just got a weird vibe like something's going up, and I don't think we're ever gonna meet Diane. I just laying that down right now.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And he is very pleased with his damn fine cup of coffee at breakfast, and we get the first meeting of Audrey and Coop. Chemistry? What do you guys reckon?
It seemed like there was something going on, but he's like an FBI agent, and she's, I assume, supposed to be like about 17. So it was kind of, I was just like, But I mean, I could definitely see the appeal.
Definitely. She's stunning. I think any guy would find it hard to resist Audrey Horne.
Yeah, I finally figured out who she reminds me of, and it's Jessica Rabbit. Just the way she acts with like that music going on. She's always walking around like Jessica Rabbit. So, yeah. But he... It was just weird.
There's something about, like, she always feels like she should have an internal soundtrack, in a way. So then he goes off to the police station, where Coop gives Truman a rundown of what they're going to do. And it's just hilarious, because Truman's just, like, stuffed this... I don't know what it is that he's eating. Is it, like, a Twinkie roll or something? Like, just puts the whole thing in his mouth.
Like a good old powdered American donut.
That was my guess. Yeah, I think it was just a donut.
So brilliant. And it just makes him seem even more ridiculously foolish than anything else. So we have Doc Hayward take through the autopsy report showing that Laura had sex with three different men that night. And then we cut in a very suggestive way to Leo giving Shelley a blood-stained denim shirt that she hides rather than putting in the washer-dryer. Which always struck me as ridiculous that you would have your washer dryer outside the house. Like, why would no
one... Me too! I was like, is that a thing? I've never seen a washer or dryer outside.
Does that Canada? Happen?
Is that a Canadian thing?
First of all, this isn't set in Canada.
No, I'm just asking. It might as well be.
Is there an assumption like it's weird, so it must be Canadian?
I was just being a stupid American there. I didn't actually think you'd do that.
Canada is America's weird doppelganger, where strangeness is routine, but it's always freakishly familiar.
Sounds like maybe Wales is to England. Or Scotland.
I'd never seen an outside washer dryer, but I just sort of assumed it was kind of some old-fashioned thing, which went along with a lot of the stuff here, like the gas pumps.
But for some reason, I can picture why it makes sense, even though I've never seen it myself. Like large appliances outside of the house, maybe because it needs a certain kind of utility hookup. Not to mention the inside of the house doesn't look entirely finished, so maybe it was moved out for those reasons. I think it's just weird, and there's no justification for it.
Actually, yeah, now that you say it, maybe it's just because they're remodeling, so they've just temporarily put stuff outside. But anyway, Leo is just being all like weird and creepy. And then we have Coop and Truman interrogating James Hurley, who kind of quite sweetly admits that Laura was doing cocaine and she tried to get her off of it, but that she was apparently afraid of Bobby. And then when they show him the locket, he flashes back to when she gave him her half, which is all quite sort of sweet and gloopy. And then we cut to jail where Bobby admits to Mike that he didn't... Apparently they've been in some kind of drug deal, I guess, with Leo, and that he's given some of the money to Laura, and obviously she's died, now they can't get it back, so they're kind of, like, really frightened of Leo. So we know that Bobby and Mike are kind of sketchy.
If we didn't know already.
Yeah, if we didn't know already. But, like, seriously, if you were Leo and you were actually a drug runner, would you use these feckless fools to go into...
Well, Leo doesn't strike me as particularly smart. I mean, I think he's a genuine psychopath, and I can see him, like, yeah, let's get these kids to do this, it's easy. But then, of course, something goes wrong, and he can blame for it, but...
Yeah.
I don't have much experience running drugs with anybody, so I don't know.
Yeah, so if anyone has any experience of Montreal whorehouses and drug running cross-border, then please get in touch. We have questions. Questions
all
that need
VOK
answers.
All our VOK long-distance truckers out there, call in.
Exactly. Okay, so then we have this really sugary scene. I think, like, the Haywood family is meant to be this lovely family in contrast with the Horn family, maybe. So, you know, Donna wakes up late, her mother's so understanding, and, you know, she admits she's in love with James and all that nonsense. And I guess this is the point also, because James is released into Big Ed's custody, and we realise that Ed works, I guess, off the books for Truman. And he thinks he was drugged by the bartender Jacques Renault at the Roadhouse. So it's a name to remember, boys.
Uh-oh, foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
All those crazy Quebecois, you know, Canadians.
Okay.
Causing trouble. I'm really pleased we have a Canadian on this podcast, actually. It's going to make stuff far more interesting.
Well, call me up if you ever need a token Canadian. I'm around.
So polite.
And then we have this, like, really weird conversation between Nadine and Norma, which is all about Silent Grape Runners. But so Nadine knows, right? She knows that Ed and Norma are doing something together.
I kind of took it that she didn't, because she was so crazy she'd kill them both.
Yeah.
It's just so menacing, the way she kind of... Her body, maybe it's like that to everyone, though, I guess. What's your theory about the eye patch?
It's just an affectation. She doesn't actually need it.
It's very comfortable. I think everyone will be wearing an eye patch. And then Coop and Truman go to the mill to question Josie because Laura was giving her English lessons, and Coop realizes that they're lovers. I find it so unbelievable that Josie would be having an affair with Truman. I'm just going to throw that out there.
But he's like,
small town, there's not a lot of options.
Yeah, he's like that. Oops, that was Jonah.
He also disagrees. He's a man of insight.
It's kind of like the trope you see, you know, the upper class girl and the lower class guy, you know, the rugged working class guy. That's what I kind of got from it.
But if that were the case, surely she'd be shagging Big Ed.
Big Ed's busy.
Which one's Big Ed?
Big Ed's gas bomb, the one who's shagging Norma.
He's already got an old lady.
Yeah, but you can have more than one.
Big Ed doesn't have time for that.
He doesn't seem too bright. I don't think he could juggle two.
Because Truman's bright, yes. And then we have, like, my favorite line in the whole of Twin Peaks, when Pete Martell Riston, "Don't drink the coffee. There's a fish in the percolator."
Dope. Like it's just, like, it happens. What can you do?
Yeah, because that shit happens.
And after he says that, they still both swallow the coffee in their mouths, which is weird to me. That didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, why would you not just spit it out? And then later when they go to the Double R Diner, they're like, oh, I can't get the taste of fish out of my mouth.
Now, his wife did that just because she's a bitch, right? Or is that just supposed to be some oops, somehow it got in there?
I don't think we ever know, do we? I mean, Catherine's not around when they go, is she?
Well, he does mention it to his wife. Doesn't he mention it to his wife at some point? Like, and someone put a fish in the percolator. Who could that be? And she was in her crazy mode.
I kind of feel like Catherine would feel that was quite petty. I mean, she's as we now discover, in this huge plot with Ben to basically sell the sawmill for tuppence and, like, redevelop it into the Ghostwood development and make a fortune.
Well, I got that petty was her main character trait when she fired that guy.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But if she doesn't actually have any power, then she can't really... I hope he didn't actually get fired. I thought, like, Josie Kanach is like, you can stay. But we didn't see that.
Well, no, I think Catherine really just runs the mill and Josie stays out of it. Like, she says this is the only time I've ever taken this authority of managing it. So I think that guy's fired.
Oh. Now I'm sad.
That sucks. That's the worst.
That does suck. Because it's probably, like, the only employer in town as well, right? I mean...
But it can't be, because there's 50,000 people there.
Exactly.
It's See, if this was a town of 10,000, this would make a lot more sense.
There's a big fishing industry too. We just don't see it.
Not to mention the narcotics industry.
Just like British Columbia.
Was that like an interregional joke at the expense of BC that none of us get?
There are several Canadians smiling right now who listen to this. It's fine.
So are they like the Welsh of Canada, or?
I don't know what Wales is to the rest of England.
You've also already referenced Kingdom. Canada as the Wales of America.
Kind of like the sort of the Cletus, the slack-jawed yokel, the sort of the people that we would sort of look down on this thing.
Well, British Columbia is the province north of Washington. They're kind of famous pot smokers. In fact, a study showed that the largest part of British Columbia's GDP comes from the drug trade.
Oh, okay. And how?
But they're really nice drug dealers, right?
Oh yeah, of course.
With excellent socialized healthcare.
I mean, it's marijuana. It's not cocaine. Come on.
Barely even a drug. Okay. We apologize to the people of Wales and British Columbia. Please don't hate us.
That should go in the opening of the show.
as well as all Americans who think their coffee is awesome and have never been to Europe.
Hey, I don't know if you've heard Bina, but America runs on Dunkin', so it's fine.
You run on Dunkin'?
That's their campaign slogan, America runs on Dunkin'.
America sits on a couch and gets fat on Dunkin', would probably be more accurate now. Please don't sue us, Dunkin' Donuts. Okay. America waddles slowly on Dunkin'.
Oh, right.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm being so mean today. I think maybe it's because I'm 6.
We woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning to talk to you.
4:30.
I'm sorry.
Oh, jeez, I'm sorry.
I'm really sorry. I'll try and be nice from now on. I think maybe I'm just absorbing the Catherine Martell character. So anyway, Donna goes to visit Sarah Palmer. And, ooh, as she hugs Donna, she sees a man crouching behind the sofa and screams as Leland runs in to comfort her. So how do you interpret that kind of long, grey-haired, crouching guy? What thoughts, people?
I think I know who he is. I think it's one of the things I've been spoiled on, so.
Oh, okay. Stephen, Greg, any thoughts?
I missed it. Actually, they just started doing some, like, cutting trees down right outside my window, so I didn't hear anything you guys said.
So, we cut to the scene where Donna goes to visit Sarah, and there's this kind of weird, long, grey-haired guy, like, crouching behind the sofa that she sees instead of, like, a vision.
Oh, I didn't know what the hell was going on with that. I didn't know if she was, like, having a psychotic break and just seeing something, but knowing what happens in the next episode, okay, I know who that is, or who we kind of know who that is, but I didn't have a thought because I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Somehow I totally missed that. When I read this in the notes, I was like, what the hell are you talking about? I need to go back and see if this is real.
Yeah, you do need to go back, and I would strongly suggest, because it will be significant. And it is kind of like fairly creepy as well. It's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I did think it was pretty well done for, you know, like a cheap TV scare. The way it uses the music and the angles and the camera and everything. It's a good little jump.
The other thing to know is that although, you know, you do need to go back and watch it because it will become significant, it happened as a total accident. The guy who plays that character was a set dresser, and he just happened to be in the shot, realizing he was in the shot, so crouching. And David Lynch saw it and realized it was just really freaky and decided to then build that into the whole plot of the show.
Genius, keep it in.
And apparently he's like a really nice guy. And the other thing that was accident was, you know when they go to see the body of Laura in the pilot and they pull out the letter under thing and the lights are flickering in the morgue and it's quite freaky? That was a genuinely dodgy bulb, and David Lynch decided to keep it in.
I really hated that scene. I know it was done. There's the part where he's reaching in for the letter where it looks like those tweezers go like 6 centimeters under the nail. Like it is. Like you go, okay, he has to have it now, and then he goes deeper, and then you're like, okay, that has to be it, and then he goes deeper again, and it's just, I don't like body horror. It was upsetting.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought when you said you hated it, you thought it was badly done, but okay, slightly.
No, flickering fluorescent lights, that's a sign of quality television right there.
Does that mean that the moose on the table was just like, oh, they came to set that day and like, there's a moose head there, we'll keep it in the scene?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised actually, but I genuinely don't know on that one. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise
me. That's good to know though.
Yeah. So then we discover the Pulaskis at the hospital. They reveal to Deputy Hawk that Renette worked at the perfume counter at Horn's department store, and he sees a one-armed man who he follows through the hospital but loses. One-armed man, thoughts, boys and girls?
I thought that was the time that The Fugitive came out, right?
Yeah, I thought it was first Jacoby too, and so I didn't catch that it was a different character.
Oh, okay, cool. And then we have like one of the coolest scenes where Audrey is just like dancing alone, and then Ben confronts her about the Norwegians leaving, so I guess just more evidence of the coolness of Audrey. And then we have, oh my god, I wish my father had been Major Briggs, because like the scene where he's trying to chastise Bobby is just so hilarious. It's like, well, I realize that social norms are that you're going to act out at your age, and that social norms are that I should chastise you, so let's play this little game. And then Bobby's being all nonchalant, and then she just like slaps him.
Yeah.
Oh, great kind of job.
Well, because I wanted to slap Bobby or Tommy like every single scene, so I'm glad somebody slapped him.
Yeah, he is quite slappable.
But it did kind of take me by surprise because I didn't even know if he was that kind of guy. And then the mom's just eating her mashed potatoes like, it's okay. This happens every day.
Although, I mean, as you'll discover, the relationship between Major Briggs and Bobby, I think, is actually quite... It's one of the most authentically moving things in the show, but when you first see it, it just comes across as utterly weird.
I think the I don't know if it's the actor's natural way of doing it, the way he plays Bobby, but he just, the way he walks and just kind of slouches, it's like he's doing a great job. You just want to slap him.
Yeah.
I think that's the point. Like when they go to Doc Hayward's house and he's like standing on the bonnet of the car, like drinking and like surfing.
That's the one. We'll get to that.
Okay, so Coop and Truman are having a slice of pie at the Double R Diner, trying to get the taste of fish out of their mouth. And Norma tells them that in addition to tutoring Josie in English and helping out Johnny, the autistic kid, she also started a Meals on Wheels program, and that she'll give them a list of the people on her route. And the log lady comes up to them and says that her log saw something that night, but, you know, she tells them to ask the log what the log saw, and they kind of look skeptical, so she kind of leaves in a huff.
Yeah, I don't understand why Cooper's being skeptical.
At this point, what's your take on the log lady?
I imagine that if the killer isn't revealed by the end of the series, that David Lynch will say, oh, if they asked the log lady, she would have told them everything, but they refused to ask the logs, therefore the mystery remains. I would expect that kind of answer from David Lynch.
So you think the log really did see something?
Of course not, it's a log, but the lady is insane and uses a log as a tool to communicate with other people.
Well, that's me told.
Yeah, I see her as the town eccentric, but like she's the one person in town that actually does know what's going on, but no one takes her seriously.
Cassandra.
So she definitely knows what's going on.
Yeah. She also has some fantastically 80s glasses on, where the glasses like are so big, they cover your whole face.
Yeah, I can see why in the show Cooper would sort of dismiss her at this point, since we haven't seen the Tibetan thing. But after seeing that, I don't understand why he would dismiss anything.
Exactly. Like, he seems very comfortable in the realm of the weird. So then we switch to Leo beating Shelley up when he can't find his shirt. And we cut to a cross town where we sit down to this really warm-hearted family meal, where James meets the Hayward family. And Mike and Bobby see his bike outside Donna's house and are not well disposed towards him. And then we cut to Doc Hayward listening to a tape diary entry that Laura sent him. And she talks about how dumb and sweet James is, and a mystery man that she's going to meet. And he opens up a coconut that contains the half locket he dug up. And I think at this point I really thought Dr. Jacoby was the killer.
Oh, I didn't get that vibe at all. That's interesting.
So what did you think at the end of the episode? I think that's what Lynch is trying to make us think anyway, by having him have the locket. Or not. I don't know.
No, well, I think that's where... I think the problem is Dr. I approach Jacoby. These things so cynically. Like, Jacoby obviously is a weird guy and creepy, but just like Leo, like, obviously Leo is so horrible, therefore he can't be the killer. And Dr. Jacoby is really creepy, therefore he can't be the killer. Like, to reveal it this early on would be strange, but that's just me being cynical and having watched too many murder mysteries.
Yeah, no, I was confused. I got my doctors mixed up. Yeah, he's the guy who I did think did it. I thought you meant the kind, the nice doctor.
Oh, Doc Hayward. Yeah, that would be very subversive if Doc Hayward did it.
That would be really messed up.
But we skipped the part. I got where Bobby and Tommy show up. Tommy and Mike show up to to find Donna, and like they're both drinking and driving, and the town doctor has no problem with them. Even when he calls the cops, he's like, "Hey, I think I know where they are." He doesn't mention that they're drunk driving. Like, and maybe that's
well,
he
does. He does say to Bobby, "You're not drinking." He does say to
but he lets him go, and then when he calls the cop, like he doesn't even mention it to the sheriff. It's just like they're going to the roadhouse. It just seemed it took me out of it in this age of PC and you know. This whole anti-junk, which is completely, you know, should be that way. It just took me out of it. Like, oh yeah, that's just a thing that was people let people do back then.
No, I'm not sure that's true, but yeah.
Okay.
Whenever someone's rude to like a girl's parents, it like he's a bad guy.
In life, in general, Shane, is that a rule?
Absolutely.
If someone doesn't
Texas
respect
gentlemen.
Parents,
it just kind of really annoyed me.
Yeah, but you probably come from a part of the world where people still call people sir and ma'am, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
That's brilliant. Actually, there's a wonderful line where Coop says, or I think it's Truman says to Coop, why are you whistling or whittling or something? And Coop says, that's what you do in a town where orange lights still mean slow down rather than speed up, which I think is a lovely way of putting it. Okay, any other comments on episode one?
I have a quick question. So the nature of Jimmy and Laura's relationship, are we to believe they were romantically involved or that Jimmy just loved Laura or what?
I think we're meant to believe that James was in love with Laura and that Laura liked the idea of the wholesomeness of James, but that there was a lot going on. So you mean, did they have any rumpy pumpy?
Sure. when they were looking at the locket, when Laura gives it to Jimmy, I thought it said best friends on it. And not anything romantic. I could have imagined that whole thing. I'm actually going to look it up in a second.
Oh, okay. But, I missed that then if it said best friends on it.
So it seemed strange to me, you know, that Jimmy and Laura would have this side relationship, yet there seems to be something going on between him and Laura's friend as well.
Yeah, I thought we were supposed to believe that they were like madly like Romeo and Juliet almost, and then it wasn't until after Laura had died that him and Donna started realizing that they actually were in love with each other the whole time.
Yeah,
I think the locket said like friend best. It might have said friends forever or best. Yeah.
It says I'm looking it up on Google Images. It says best friends, so okay. It's not.
But do you
romantic.
Really give someone a locket to say best friends? I mean.
I give all my friends lockets. What's wrong with that?
Surely you only give a locket to someone that you're actually in love with. I mean...
Oh, that's why I'm the weird guy.
Friend zone.
Oh god, I have to reinterpret my life now.
Dating tips 101. I mean, I think...
I took it to be that, you know, they were definitely seeing each other. How far they'd win, I don't know. But definitely that it was more James, or at least it appeared to be more James than Laura. But we see... that James really wasn't that into her as much as he thought anyway.
I think it's definitely more James than Laura. He strikes me as one of those guys who, you know, there's always, not just guys, but guys and girls who go for people who they think they can fix. Mm. And you see these quite, you know, one-sided relationships where they go for the trouble people because they have this sort of knight in shining armor complex. And that's why I always thought it was credible that when Laura was dead and he saw Donna fall, like really traumatized, that he would then transfer that love to Donna because, you know, he can fix her, or it's a way for them to sort of still have Laura in their lives. But I think
so one of the things the show's clearly setting up is that Laura was living two different lives, and
oh,
I think right. So I think Jimmy appeals to the Laura that's doing the Meals on Wheels and teaching English and helping Audrey's special needs brother. Like Jimmy fits with that, the sweet puppy dog eyed. Innocent boy, and you know, whatever relationship she has with Bobby is more inclined towards whatever dark side Laura's life had, or even, you know, Leo even makes a comment like Laura was a wild girl in the next episode, which we haven't seen a ton of evidence of until that point. So, you know, maybe it's just kind of representing the other thing. I think James was probably in love with Laura, but Laura just kind of kept him around because she liked him, but not in a romantic sense.
I completely agree. And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, all of Lynch's works is about the sort of the hidden subversive lives underneath the perfect picket fence, you know, reality that we project. And Laura will have layers and layers to her life, as does everyone in Twin Peaks, right? They're all adulterers. They're all up to no good.
We are all onions.
So profound.
There's an episode title right there.
Damn it.
Well, I'm gonna have to get out of here. My household is up and about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
That's cool. Do you have any comments quickly on episode 2, like the dream at the end? Maybe you want to share before you go, or have you got a bug out?
I don't know. I'm still just not really drawing any conclusions. Just kind of taking it all in. But well, I don't want to. I think I'm drawing on some of the things I've heard before in the past. So. Yeah, I don't really have much to add.
Okay, cool. Have a great day, Shane.
All right, take it easy, Shane.
Alrighty, see y'all later.
Bye, Shane.
And so leaves Shane. Okay, so on to episode 2, Zen, or the skill to catch a killer. Which I think we'd all agree is the episode when we really realise that Twin Peaks is going to be a little bit weird.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. This is the episode where it's like, oh right, this is a crazy show. This is not rational or normal at all.
And it starts off with the best scene ever, which is we're at the Great Northern. We have this really quiet, weird breakfast with the Horn family in silence. And Johnny's wearing a red Indian headdress. And then Jerry Horn turns up from Paris with these massive brie baguettes that remind the brothers of Ginny and Jenny down by the river. And like, it's probably like one of like the best eating food scenes ever, I think.
It just makes me think, it's like all the stories you hear of like filming behind the scenes, of any scenes where you had to eat, like the actors usually get so sick of having to do 25 takes and there's a spit bucket, but they seemed so to enjoy those sandwiches so much that I think like they were just, Lynch kept them starving and then like had them enjoy their sandwich and that they were actually eating because it looked genuine. It didn't look like they were, you know, like, oh, take 25, another baguette, you know?
I think the lesson here is if you don't like food, don't work with David Lynch because he'll be shoving donuts and baguettes into your face at a pace. No human being should eat food.
Well, yeah. And don't watch Twin Peaks hungry. I love the chemistry between Ben and Jerry. I think they're absolutely hilarious. And they get all sad and depressed because the Norwegians have left. And then Jerry's like, oh, did you say Leland's daughter died? And then they hop in a boat to Canada to go to One-Eyed Jack's to see the new girl. We meet the Madam Blackie, and the brothers toss a coin for the new girl, and Ben wins. Did you think the new girl looked a little reluctant and scared? Because I certainly did.
Yeah, I definitely did.
It's a really nasty little scene.
Yeah.
Okay, and then we sort of cut back to midnight in the Haywood house, and Donna and James declaring their love for each other. Oh. And Deputy Hawk calls Coop and tells him about the one-armed man at the hospital. And someone slips a note under Coop's door saying Jack with one eye. So who are you thinking did that, boys?
I was thinking Josie, but it's like whoever did it is going out of their way to not give him information directly. It's like, yeah, I'm going to give you a hint, but you're still going to have to work for it.
Indeed. Although it's not a big sort of rearrangement of One-Eyed Jack's, in fairness.
Right, but it did take them half an episode to work out that, oh, that's what it is.
Yeah, true. And then Mike and Bobby go into the woods with Leo's money and a football, and we see some sort of mysterious man behind them. And Big Ed gets grease all over Nadine's grape runner.
Critical plot detail.
Critical plot detail, because in anger we see her, the first evidence of this sort of superhuman strength when she like totally rips the rowing machine out of shape.
What do you mean first evidence? Is that gonna come back to play?
Shit, no.
Spoilers!
I've done what I shouldn't have done. I'll stick
to it. Shoot lasers out of that other eye that she's Cyclops, that's why she's gotta keep it covered up.
No, but I mean, surely you guys must have noticed that. I mean, that isn't normal to sort of suddenly bend a rowing machine out of shape. Or not? Did I completely ruin it?
Oh, we're strong men, so of course we break our exercise equipment when we're done with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then we cut to, I guess it's the next morning, right? So Shelley switches off an invitation to love, the soap opera within the soap opera that she's watching on TV. And she tells Bobby that she thinks Leo will kill them both if he ever finds out about them. But Bobby promises to kill Leo first if he ever hits her again. So my question to you guys is, at this point, you've heard James tell, I think, the cops that Laura was afraid of Bobby, and Bobby say that he'll kill Leo. Do you believe that Bobby's dangerous at this point?
Well, I thought he was a talker to begin with, but I'm starting... the scene with him telling her that, you know, I'll kill anyone if he Leo if he touches you again, it almost made him more of a gray character than a black character. Like, okay, he does actually love this woman, and I think he would do anything for her. But I don't think he's as stupid or as just this... As we're introduced to him as, like, the stupid jock, I don't think he's actually that stupid.
Yeah, I agree.
It seems to me like he's playing tough, right? Like, mm-hmm. he's... involved in a criminal enterprise, but at no level does it seem, it seems strange to use in this context, professional or well thought out. It just seems like a scheme he and his buddy cooked up with Leo. I don't honestly believe that he's going to commit any violence at all.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the whole weird, you know, crime duo with him and Mike. I mean, Mike is, it's Mike's his friend, right? He's the stupid guy of the group, who's the muscle, just going along with it. You know, he brings the knife. That he's not really thinking, but it's definitely Bobby's. He's got some brains. Tommy's got some brains to carry on with, or just to get to this point already.
Right.
But we have to carry on without being it temporarily.
Yes. I don't know what to make of Bobby and his friend. Like, on one point, they feel like the familiar, you know, jockey duo, but they are up to some nasty stuff. But once again, it feels, I don't know how much of Twin Peaks I'm discounting because it's set up a bunch of tropes or it's playing with tropes, therefore I'm not paying attention to them. Like, you know, the angry boyfriends, you know, who are being cheated on by their girlfriend killer. Like, that's a very common murder mystery plot, yet that does not seem at all plausible.
Right.
Like, the more we meet Bobby, the more he seems completely disconnected from whatever happened to Laura. He doesn't even seem that bent out of shape that she died.
Yeah, it's true, so, actually. Whereas he does seem like very genuinely... I always thought there was quite a lot of chemistry between him and... what's the name of the girl he's sleeping with? Shelley. Yeah. I mean, maybe you guys haven't seen it quite yet, but...
I mean, they ride off from the diner together. That's, you know, that romantic drive up to the truck.
Yeah.
And then the peeling out at breakneck speed.
Yeah, it's kind of cute. Okay, then Coop takes the police station crew to the woods where, with an epic display of donuts and a blackboard, he tells them that he once had a dream of Tibet, and when he awoke, he had this mystical deductive reasoning technique, and that he basically has Truman read out all the J names in town, and he throws a rock at a bottle, and when the name of Jacoby is read out, the bottle falls but doesn't break. He hits the bottle but it doesn't break. When he says Leo Johnson, it does actually break.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the coolest scenes ever.
Definitely my favorite scene so far.
Really? It seems so strange. Like, I watch it, I'm like, oh, come on. Ease me into this a little more. Like, this is...
Well, at that point, you've had, like, 2 hours worth of Twin Peaks, I mean.
Yeah, so far to me, Dale Cooper is kind of an eccentric character. He's not weird yet. And, you know, like, Truman shoving donuts in his face. But they still seem like reasonable, rational, somewhat realistic people. And then... You know, the fact that the entire police department of Twin Peaks is like, oh no, this makes total sense. He's figured it out. We got to go investigate Leo Johnson. And no one, it's kind of the surreal element, but I don't know. I broke it down a little bit, maybe because this is kind of the peak weirdness until later on in this episode.
I think it's kind of like, to me, what was weird was not like him doing his whole, and here's a map of Tibet. It was more the fact that like nobody else blinked an eye. Like, it was everybody else's reaction.
Where did he get
it?
That map from? Does he travel with it? And they're like, who brings that giant blackboard in the middle of the woods?
It's just so
the funny. FBI, that's who.
Yeah, I guess.
So that's one thing we learn about the federal government, is that it has the resources to make anything happen that it wants. Yeah. So anyway, like, obviously all the fingers are being pointed at Leo Johnson in this episode. We then switch to Audrey, who has a cup of coffee at the Double R Diner and asks Donna... Well, she has this, like, really weird conversation with Donna. And you can tell that they weren't really ever friends before the death, but they somehow have a connection now. And she just, almost in a throwaway line, asks if Laura ever talked about her father. But it's kind of not in a maybe suspicious, sketchy way, just kind of weird. And he says... She has this weird line where she says, he used to sing to her. God, I love this music. Isn't it too dreamy? And then she just starts dancing, which is amazing. But what do you make of that Ben Horn used to sing to Laura line?
It's something that he just put out there, and I don't know if we're meant to take it as there's something deeper going on there, but it's definitely a question mark and kind of a haunting, you know, just a single line. But it, I assume it's going somewhere. And we know she has this kind of connection to music that it might be her escape from her awful life or something like that. And maybe that's when her father was good in her life, is when he used to sing to her. Mm. And he doesn't sing anymore.
Oh.
I took it as Laura has, you know, the squeaky clean image on the surface, but maybe she also had a relationship with Horn and was either sleeping with him or something else was going on there.
Yeah, both very valid. And then we just have basically Albert Rosenfield arriving, being hilariously insulting.
That was great.
Yes, because he, I think at, by this point we've seen a lot of weird and a lot of kind of small town craziness, and he just comes in this very like comedic, insulting way and expresses all of our frustration with what's been happening. Like, what is this nonsense? Let's just get some facts. Let's do an autopsy and get some actual answers here. But there you go. He's great.
Yeah, I love when he opens the folder, just kind of looks over the paper for 4 seconds, sighs, and is like, looks like it's amateur hour. I kind of love how much of a dick he is in that scene. It's pretty great.
But also, in fairness, Truman does show some balls, so, you know, good for him.
Yeah, it's a good scene for a lot of characters in that room. Like, it's great for Lucy, she's hilarious. If it's great for Rosenfield, it's great for Truman.
Indeed. And then Big Ed comes home, and Nadine is super excited about how the greasy cotton balls have created silent train runners. And Josie discovers that Catherine has been keeping 2 sets of books at the mill. And then I guess we have the kind of the double ending, which is just all really, really weird. So the first part of that is we have Leland Palmer at home, and he looks really disheveled. And he puts on a record of Pennsylvania 6500 and holds a picture of Laura and starts kind of screaming and dancing. And it's just all really, really, really weird. And then Sarah tries to stop him and she starts screaming, Leland, what is going on in this house? And it's... I hate that scene. But, it's so horrible.
Yeah, it's a haunting scene, but I like how it kind of flips out, because when you first find out about Laura, it's the mother that's freaking out and the father has to be like her anchor, and this completely flips it where he's just losing it and she has to bring him back to reality. It bookends it nicely, I thought.
Absolutely. Very moving, I think. I mean, it's in one sense, like, both of the acting is quite over the top, but there is something very genuine and authentic and grieving. I really feel for them in the scene.
Mm-hmm. And the way he like smears the blood on, you don't know if he's like doing that on the picture after he cuts himself, and it's just this weird, like, is that like, is he meaning to do that? Is that like an homage or what's going on there? But it's just the whole scene was cut right to the bone.
Yeah.
Like, that's the one connection he has, is to dance with the picture of his daughter. It's super sad.
So we go from that, which is a sort of very melodramatic but somehow strangely credible scene of grief, to Coop's dream, where he's in the red room, capital R, with a shaking dwarf with his back to him. And then he sees a man coming down the stairs of the Palmer house, which is the man that Sarah Palmer saw hiding behind the couch. And the one-armed man who recites, through the darkness of future past, the magician longs to see one chance between two worlds. Fire, walk with me. We lived among the people, above a convenience store. I too have been touched by the devilish one, a tattoo on the left shoulder. But when I saw the face of God, I took the entire arm off. My name is Mike, and his name is Bob. And Killer Bob promises to kill again. So a lot of clues and craziness in that speech. What did you guys make of it, that first part of the Red Room dream?
Nothing. I knew the scene was coming, like, I've heard about it so much, and I specifically didn't want to Google anything, I just want to take it, and, yeah, it's, we know, does he have a psychic connection, is he just dreaming this, or is this part of his whole weird Tibetan, you know, other level of consciousness that he's on, that he's actually, this is actual concrete stuff happening, or if he's just crazy, but more questions than answers, yes.
Yeah, I think from the show and what we know and how everything's presented, that we have to take the dream seriously. Like, there is valuable information in here to be interpreted. That being said, when you're watching it and you're not doing any follow-up, because like Greg, I'm not looking this stuff up later because I'm afraid it'll provide too much context and I won't know, you know, it'll just spoil a show that's 25 years old. And so trying to just absorb it on the screen is very challenging. Like, there's a lot of stuff there, and it's all in kind of a verse, and it's not clear. Like, I don't know what any of this means. Reading it now in the show notes is the first time I've actually had a chance to study it, and I still can't really put anything together from it.
It was really weird, because when it first came on TV, it was kind of before the age of the internet, so what would happen is you'd tape it on VCR and then you'd go around to your friends' houses on the weekend and try and watch it again and figure out what's going on, but that was your forum chat room, so nobody had a clue. It's kind of different to these days when you have clues, like if you read George R. R. Martin, and you can try and dissect what the prophecies mean online with the hive mind. I mean, it was just incredibly painful back then. So
this is probably a really silly amount of interpretation and probably blatantly obvious, but it's in a red room, and so that had me thinking of The Shining, and obviously red room is murder, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think that's very, that's what we're meant to think, I think, right?
Yeah.
And so then in the second part of the dream, we come out of that vision, and an aged Coop is back in the red room with the dwarf and someone who we think is Laura Palmer. She taps her nose, and the dwarf says, "I've got good news. That gum you like is going to come back in style. She's my cousin, but doesn't she look almost exactly like Laura Palmer?" And then she says, "I feel like I know her, but sometimes my arms bend back." And then the dwarf says, "She's filled with secrets. Where we're from, the birds sing a pretty song, and there's always music in the air." And then he then starts dancing, and the lights flicker. And Laura kisses Coop and whispers in his ear. And Coop wakes up and calls Harry, telling him he knows who killed Laura Palmer, but that it can wait until morning. Which is such a mean ending.
Yeah. So, I hope the next episode opens with, like, them going to breakfast, and the sheriff's like, "What did you want to tell me?" He's like, "Oh, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I wrote something down on my paper, and then I looked at it in the morning, and I didn't know what it was about, so I don't know what's going on." But I don't think it's going to go that way.
Well, you could be surprised. But so how do you feel about this Laura Palmer vision? Just, again, just letting it wash over you, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing about the dwarf talking backwards, like, I knew that was coming, and it met all my expectations of how odd it was supposed to be, and I'm sure I could try to parse out little things, and just the way that their words didn't quite match up. You know, I did look online just to see how they actually did that, like, if they were speaking backwards, and the fact that they used subtitles to tell you what they were saying, I think they're trying to be intentionally misleading, because, like, if you didn't have those subtitles, I don't know if you could actually understand what they were saying.
So how they did it, I think, is they spoke the words backwards into a tape recorder, mm-hmm. and then reversed it. So they are actually speaking forwards when you hear it, but because they've kind of done it backwards, it's kind of like the emphasis on the vowels and all that is kind of really weird. And mm-hmm. I think the dwarf is better at it, or more intelligible, than the actress playing Laura Palmer.
Yeah, I actually looked that up because they said that he actually had, like, a secret language with his friends, the actor who plays the dwarf, when he was a child. They used to speak backwards, and, like, so he was really good at it. And David Lynch didn't know anything about that, and he was super happy about that.
What a weird coincidence.
Yeah.
I also love the way he dances. It's just so... And the music is just so weird and groovy. Like, it's kind of weird. Like, so much sinister happens in those dreams. I found... The first time I watched it, I found the one-armed man utterly petrifying. And Bob, Killer Bob, utterly petrifying. But there was something about the dwarf that just felt very kind of friendly and helpful. And weird, but in a good way.
But I got a feeling that he's not actually being helpful.
You guys are so cynical. So, yeah, like, why doesn't Coop tell Harry?
It goes with the whole, just the way he handles his info. Like, he plays his cards very close to the chest. And I understand that, but it was incredibly frustrating. And even in this day of Netflix where I could just press play and go to the next episode, I specifically didn't. Because
you guys are so self-disciplined. I would never have been able to stop.
Well, I feel like this is the kind of show... I mean, it was... Even some of the way... Like, you know, there were commercials originally, and the way some scenes end, it seems silly, and, like, the way they cut, but then you realize that there were commercials between there, and that does make sense that they did it that way. But when you're just watching it in a row, it's kind of... It's just a weird way they do that. And I think you're meant to have some space between them, like... And I think I'll appreciate it more if I do that.
It's definitely, I think, nicer watching it like we watch it now, because the mysterious atmosphere is kept. And actually, when we originally saw it air in the UK, it was on BBC, so no ads anyway, which is great because you just sustain the kind of the sinister, mysterious, beautiful atmosphere of it.
Yeah.
I feel like the dream, this sequence kind of confirms what I've said earlier in the episode, where that Laura is living a double life. You know, the part where she says, "She's filled with secrets, and I feel like I know her, but sometimes my arms bend back, or that I almost look exactly like her." It's like, this is the other, like, there's two sides of her personality, and obviously they look very similar. And if I'm going to put on my, you know, literary analysis hat, if she's talking about her arms bend back, my thought went to, like, Janice and a two-faced person, and the faces face opposite ways.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's a really good one.
So I assume, you know, this represents the two sides of Laura's personality, and maybe the side that's running around participating in drug deals is what got her killed, while the, you know, the quote-unquote innocent side is sitting here in a red room with a dwarf in perpetuity, not knowing why she died.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, are you guys excited for the next three episodes then?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, we've got some good stuff coming up. So, thank you for joining. I've watched it a lot of times actually, so it's really, in a way, it's really nice to watch it with people who haven't seen it before, because you get to see it a little bit through your eyes as well. So it seems a bit more fresh. I really hope there's lots of people watching it now. It was always very, in the UK at least, quite underground. I mean, it was like hyped, but then, I don't know.
It's definitely in the culture, like there's references to it all over the place, but I never got it, so I just was always felt like a step removed from it, but now I'll be on the in club, I guess, at least.
Yeah, the Simpsons actually have done a lot to reference Twin Peaks. In particular, I think it's the episode where Mr. Burns gets shot and Lisa appears to Homer in a dream as the backwards talking dwarf, and there might even be spoilers for what happens in the future of Twin Peaks if I reflect too much on that episode.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to keep yourself spoiled, but I'm really enjoying this idea that lots of people are watching it now, because, like I said, at the time, unless you were already at uni and you maybe had kind of access to some of the early internet message boards, it was one of those things that was before the kind of the forum geek popular culture kind of way of discussing shows, so I'm kind of excited that it's getting this second life. So, yeah.
Are you excited for the new season or whatever that might be?
I am excited only because I know that David Lynch apparently is going to be very heavily involved, and I think this will be something that we experience when we get to season two, which is that you can really tell the bits where, that's kind of like the middle of season two, David Lynch went off to make Fire Walk With Me, which was sort of the prequel movie, and you can definitely see a drop off in quality, and then it comes back with a finale. So if he's definitely involved, I think it will be awesome. And I'm just curious because, you know, the show got cancelled. There are a lot of questions that we don't know the answers to. So, yeah. But then again, it's Lynch, right? So he'll just set up a whole bunch of other questions and not answer those instead.
Yeah. Well, I like shows where I don't want it all to be wrapped up nicely, because life is never like that. I like the shows. I like where they just leave it open, or they might reference something and never go back to it. But of course, you do want to find out who killed Laura Palmer. But part of me is like, well, once we do, what's the point? You know, it'll just be over at that point. So.
Yeah, and I think that's something that the show definitely struggled with, this kind of combined pressure of telling or not telling, and what does the show then become? And I think that David Lynch and Mark Frost always wanted the mystery to almost recede in importance as we got to know the characters better and, you know, the mysteries that were in all of their lives. But there was obviously like a big ratings kind of necessity to actually solve the murder. But there are definitely mysteries at the end of the two seasons not related to called Laura Palmer that we need to discover the answers to. So I don't need to know everything. It's like Song of Ice and Fire. I fully expect there'll be lots of stuff George doesn't tell us the answers to, but there are certain key questions that if I don't know.
You know, I was just going to reference A Song of Ice and Fire myself on this, because A Song of Ice and Fire opens with like the central mystery is who killed John Aaron, and that's so quickly becomes
the
not the
get
point
to
of
it.
The story, right? Like it's the answer that we believe is true has been cast away in kind of a side moment. Like it's a big dramatic scene, but I'm sure a lot of people said like, well, what's going to happen next, and kept going rather than like, oh, now we know the answer.
Well, like, so, you know, who are John's parents, which I guess most of us have pretty much worked out, and you know, I'm sure that will just get a side comment in a future book just to confirm it. But
it'll be like, who sent the knife to kill Bran? By the time we actually got that answer, it was literally a throwaway line. We're like, oh yeah, we were all caring about that for an entire book.
We were obsessed with that. We started a war that savaged this continent over that question.
Yeah. But life moves on. I guess that's quite realistic in a way. So, oh, excellent. Okay, well, if that is all we have to discuss, I'd like to say thank you very much to the listener and the one Canadian listener who's frequenting Montreal warehouses. Thank you for listening. And thank you very much to Shane, who had to leave early, East Texas Star Wolf. Also, thank you to Greg.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting.
And thank you to Stephen.
Thank you.
Cool. And yeah, hopefully we'll all tune in next time and we'll do the next three episodes of Twin Peaks. So,
can't wait. Just you and I.
actually thought, I don't know, I figured one of you also would have watched it before, so this is going to be interesting, I think.
I saw bits and pieces of it when I was a kid and was confused by it, but I never watched it from the beginning.
Okay, cool.
Why on earth would this confuse you as a child?
Well, it confuses me as a grown-up, so...
It really scared me as a child. I used to have nightmares about Twin Peaks for years. Okay.
I think I know some things, like some pretty big spoilers, just from not really avoiding them, but I'm not sure, so...
Okay. So thanks.
I knew the dwarf was coming, because everyone's like, oh, that weird backwards talking dwarf, so I knew that was coming at some point.
Also The Simpsons. Like, there's like the show has such a pop cultural resonance that it's hard to avoid spoilers.
Right.
It'll be like people watching Game of Thrones or reading the books from now on, I guess. Like, they'll just know stuff.
My hair looks just like Agent Cooper's right now when he gets out of bed.